This podcast edition of The Culture Show was first aired on the 17th of October 2011 for Monocle 24 here in London. The Culture Show, in association with Mercedes-Benz. Today on Culture with me, Robert Bound, we rustle amongst the falling leaves of London's Regent's Park at the Frieze Art Fair.
The buyers for Asia, for the Middle East, for the rest of Europe, still come to London to look for some of the most important pieces.
That was art analyst Lisa Schiff. We also talked to Simon Prosser, publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, about the novels that mattered at last week's Frankfurt Book Fair.
Well, zombies are still with us, right. The undead. Come, you can't kill them, they keep coming back.
We'll be visiting one of our favourite record shops in Tokyo and checking in on New York's revamped armoury. That's an art one, not a gunpowder one. And we hear what happened when we let artist Alex Hoder loose with some of our audio kit to create an exciting and unknown minute of sound. Welcome, wherever you are in the world, to the first Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. The idea of the Culture Programme is that we make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar. We'll be speaking to film directors, songwriters, authors, artists, newspaper editors, gallerists, illustrators, auteurs, producers, publishers and the odd over-enthusiastic amateur at art gallery openings and pop concerts to illuminate the present and crystal ball the future of culture in all its forms. But coming up first on The Culture Show is the Go Team, Feel Good By Numbers.
One, two, three, four!
Thank God I'm not in the studio all on my own. I'm here with Jane Morris, the editor of the art newspaper, and with Massimo Treggiani, the director of the Shanghai Art Fair. We're here to talk Frieze. Before we talk about that, did you like that? That was my idea of a jaunty opening, that song.
It was foot tapping.
Was it, Massimo?
Yes, I love the Go Team.
Get on down. And we're obviously here to talk about Frieze. We've sort of been rustling through the leaves of Regent's Park, maybe with a canvas or two under our arm, maybe not. Jane, it's one of the busiest weeks of your year. You do a daily newspaper, which is, probably has its teething problems, and you probably see more art than you want to and see less people sometimes than you probably need to as well. But how was Frieze Week for you?
Well, I think I enjoyed it. It was a bit more subdued than in previous years, and I think it was a rather more conservative than in previous years, although that would be to be expected. But the tent looked great. There was, as always, some interesting pieces.
And Massimo, they widened the aisles at Frieze. Yes. Did you find your supermarket trolley fitted down better this year?
I like it. I mean, it's well executed, well organised. There is always something to discover. Of course, for me, it's a little bit too much on Western galleries than, you know, because I'm very interested in researching other parts of the world. And it's still, the you know, Asia and Latin America and the Middle East are still fairly underrepresented. But, you know, it's a good fair and, you know, who can complain about something like that? I mean,
why do you think it's harder for South American, maybe Asian, Middle Eastern galleries to break into that? Is it just sort of the old boys club, or is it a quality control issue? How does it work?
There are different reasons, but art fairs in the West should make an effort to work also as diplomatic tools and show art which is relevant to, you know, Western collectors and the Western general public in general, because there are a lot of prejudices.
There's always a pull between, do fairs become completely international, or do fairs retain their own individual characters so we don't end up with the identikit museum where you've got a Jackson Pollock and you've got a Warhol, that you see something you know, specific to each fair and each place. But I think that's, you know, I think that's a fair point, and I'm sure we will see more.
I want to ask one last question before we go to our package that we made at Frieze last week, and that is, how important is the fact that Frieze is in London and there are artists in London making work, not, you know, unlike maybe Basel, maybe unlike Hong Kong in certain ways, that, you know, successful art fairs, but not in cities that make art. Is it important that there's a, you know, a groundswell of stuff coming up, there's a lot of ideas in that city?
There is a sort of truism, cliche, but it's a truism really, that in general art fairs and biennales seem to succeed best in places where all the focus is on them and not on seeing lots of galleries all over the place, which is why it seems as yet New York has never managed to make a successful fair in the same way that Frieze has managed it.
Well, we traipsed off just up the road from our studios here, and this is what we saw. October saw the return of Frieze Week, when London's contemporary galleries respond to the art fair itself by doing their makeup, hitching up their skirts, and putting on their hottest shows of the year. At London's Listen Gallery, Corey Archangel, a multidisciplinary young artist from New York, filled the space with Photoshop colour test prints, silkscreen close-ups of a Roy Lichtensteiner-like polo shirt, a homage to a Kelly Clarkson pop song, and this bouncing, a Nintendo basketball game hacked to ensure Shaq never shoots a basket.
And it's been programmed that he never gets the ball in the hoop. So we're just watching Shaquille O'Neal, you know, miss continually.
Lots of people know this, but some people won't, that you did start off computer hacking.
The internet was the place where I first started to make public artwork. And, you know, in playing around with computers, I had developed lots of different ways to manipulate them, and the original definition of the word is one that actually fits with what I do. It means they're like messing with, or playing with, or playing practical jokes, or like gluing two different things together in a messy way to produce a kind of like funny or weird result, you know. And so that is kind of what I do, and it's weirdly enough like what I do even if I'm not on the computer. I think that metaphor could stand for a lot of different things. It's a good way to describe a lot of fine art, weirdly enough, you know.
People look at the works and they smile. Does that matter to you, how people respond to your works? Are you interested in watching how they respond?
I don't particularly mind one response over the other, but it is always fascinating to see what people get out of the work. What you think is going on in work and actually what is going on in the work can be hinted at with people's responses, and often it's like a bizarre mystery what a work could hold when it's out of your hands, you know? It's interesting.
No better place to see the look on people's faces as they respond to acres of art than at Frieze itself. Co-founder Amanda Sharp is still amazed at how London's changed. She remembers when it all used to be fields.
We started 20 years ago, there were 30 people in the pub. That was the whole art world. Now, 70,000 people through one fair in 7 days. That's a very substantial sea change. For the galleries in the fair, they'll know by 3 o'clock on the opening day whether or not it's worked for them. For us, The real benchmark of success, I suppose, is happy people. So you see how it affects next year, whether all the galleries want to come back, whether you get the same number of people who want to visit the fair or more. And you know what? You can just smell it in the air.
The sweet smell of expertly curated success, perhaps.
My name is Stephen Friedman. I have a gallery in Mayfair in London, Contemporary Gallery, and we've been participating in Frieze since the beginning of the art fair.
Stephen reckons London's largeness can have a downside for his potential purchases. Is there too much to do?
London, like New York, is a city with a lot of distractions. On the first day, of course, a lot of people are here, most people are here. After that, they're busy seeing other museum shows. But if you're a gallery that's coming specifically to participate in the art fair, and you're here for 5 days, you only see people on the first day, it can be a bit dispiriting. When you're in Basel, for example, really there's just a handful of other things to do, and you're really focused on the art fair at that time. Same thing in Miami, too.
Liu Ji runs one of Beijing's most successful galleries, the Long March space, and he thinks the world's getting smaller.
I think the market nowadays is not separated between, say, the East or West. These people, they go to all different continents, go to see all different fairs, and it's interesting to see different fair and different identity, different location.
But it's not all about sales. Frieze is known too for its curatorial ambitions, its things not for sale, that bit of the fair that can comment on the other bit being a shop.
I'm Sarah McCrory, and I'm the curator of Frieze Projects and Frieze Film at the fair, and the Frieze Foundation overall. Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp, when they started it, wanted to include works by artists who maybe their work doesn't fit so neatly into a gallery booth, or perhaps to allow artists to make a more significant project or try out an idea that questions the context of the fair. It is a trade fair and it is set up for that, but you also have artists, curators, museum directors, and lots of people are looking for what's happening and different ideas.
Outside the buzz of the tent, Anahita Razmi, a German-Iranian artist, reflected on one such project, a video piece displayed around inside the fair, dancers atop the flat roofs of Tehran, a symbol of protest and a reference to Trisha Brown's 1971 work called Roof Piece.
Doing a performance like that in Tehran is officially not possible. For example, there's no dance in Iran.
What's it like having your piece premiered while people are walking around with shopping bags? With nice art in, but shopping bags nonetheless.
Yeah. I mean, I quite enjoy the contradiction in it, I must say, because it is such a huge gap between it. And even when I talk about transmission, you know, okay, I take this the original Trisha Brown piece from New York and relocate it to Tehran, but then there's another step in this relocation, like going from Tehran to London. So in each step there's different things coming in, and I quite like all that is automatically coming into the piece.
There's nothing like an opening morning stampede of art-hungry millionaires to excite the appetite of an art advisor. Lisa Schiff's just that, and wouldn't miss Frieze for, well, £1 million.
You cannot ignore a fair in London. It's the one time of year for sure you're going to come here, you're going to go to all the museums, you're going to catch up with all the gallerists, you're going to see what studios you can. You kind of have to come and see what's happening here. I feel obligated to come here, and I'm happy to come here. The buyers for Asia, for the Middle East, for the rest of Europe, still come to London to look for some of the most important pieces.
Art advisors have interesting jobs, pointing buyers towards the blue chip, blue period Picassos, while keeping an eye on the emerging and the underground to help bag a bargain that'll age as gracefully and profitably as a Freud nude, but at a snip.
I think you have to be very particular about what you're buying. And I think you have to be really smart about what you're buying and thoughtful. And you have to follow the market to understand it.
Like any futures market, it's based on intelligence, gossip, and a bit of a gamble. But oil on canvas may be more reliable than half the economies of Europe. Art is an industry in which the artists actually make things. Perhaps it's a market that could teach us all a lesson.
Painting is still, hands down, the most marketable medium. And if fixed assets stay in a good position, then I think the market will stay healthy the way that it has been doing so during this really uncertain time.
Well, there's quite a lot in that to digest, dear guests. The word market and the word buying was used so much by a lot of our interviewees in that package. Do you think the market is still as bulletproof as it has been in the last sort of 9 years of Freeze? Massimo.
It's, to call it bulletproof is a bit of an overstatement. I tell people that maybe because, you know, it's not really convenient to buy stocks, you know, recently, you might as well buy art instead, and at least you end up having something that you like instead of having just numbers that disappear into the air.
A pretty investment.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting listening to Lisa Schiff at the end of that package as well. It really is. It really does sound like you are reading the FTSE 100 sometimes rather than talking about, you know, Warhols and Hearst and all the rest of it. Is that, I mean, in the numbers game, Jane, is that kind of familiar verbiage to the art buyer and art investor?
Well, I mean, obviously they're talking at an art fair, so it's a, you know, it's a commercial setting, and Lisa Schiff is an art advisor, so it's part of her job very much to do this and to work out whether she's selling things to people that will hold their value. You would expect, I think, to hear a lot of people talking like that in this particular setting. I think the question that everyone is wrestling with is that, well, it is how big this precipice is.
This is the economic precipice. This is the actual thing rather than the art market dip.
Well, I mean, this is a bit complicated, I suppose, because there's several things that could happen. But I think that in 2008, I remember going to an armory where everybody expected the art market to collapse, and it didn't, but it came later. And the question now, I think, in a lot of people's mind is, are we in the same scenario again? Or is it the case that, which many people argue, that the wealthy remained wealthy, they stopped buying because they got nervous, they stopped buying because they didn't want to be seen to be spending on something frivolous, for example, like art. Now, obviously, I don't think art is frivolous, but, you know, if you're making people redundant, then being seen on yachts buying art isn't a very good signal to be sending out. So it's that kind of dilemma, I would say, wouldn't you, Massimo?
Yeah, I mean, the market is growing. For example, I mean, I come from
the Shanghai Art Fair, clearly.
From another perspective, so I was listening carefully to Liu Jie, who's the director of Long March, which is one of the best Chinese galleries based in Beijing. And I was also carefully listening to the art advisor, who was talking only about London and New York. And there is a problem, I think, in the market, that it's, you know, we really need to bridge more and more east and west.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this.
Most of us just imagine the future, but some people are shaping it. Presented by Mercedes-Benz, The Avant-Garde Diaries is a digital portrait magazine profiling the people whose passion and creativity drive change. Meet the visionaries of our time at theavantgardediaries.com.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 25/25 city guide series. With its unique time shift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
I'm joined in the studio with Jane Morris of the Art Newspaper and Massimo Torrigiani of the Shanghai Art Fair, where we're talking about London's Freeze Art Fair, which has just finished last week. Jane, I wanted to ask, how important do you think the aesthetic curatorial element of Freeze is now?
Art fairs, I think, are very interesting places for professional people to go and have a look, but they're not the most attractive way to display art. When you come to visit, you do want to be sure that they're going to see something interesting, and the projects is one of the ways of doing that, and also the talks is another one. Art Basel has always made a big effort with Art Unlimited. It's a different way of doing it because the galleries are really proposing things to the fair organisers, but there's no doubt that Art Unlimited is a nice big showcase.
But the interesting thing that Amanda Sharp, the director of Freeze, was saying is that, you know, Frieze Art Fair was important to establish London again as a capital of contemporary art. And it's one of the most important examples of art fairs in the last 15 years that has been followed by a lot of other art fairs around the world now, that even city councils now use art fairs as tools for cultural policy. You know, because an art fair generates a buzz and an attention and an energy that no single museum, no single gallery can ever achieve.
I'd argue it helped. I mean, in fairness, I think Tate Modern had a pretty big impact. Frieze was an important part in the mix, but I think it needed the mix to make it the success that it was.
Yeah, and I think it is a success also because it's organised by a media, by a magazine, you know, and so, you know, it's an independent magazine. Also for this reason, I think that it's embedded within the DNA of Frieze to have the curatorial projects you were talking about.
I wanted to, we used the word conservative about the fair this year, Jane. I mean, is that sort of a way of understanding the market quite visually by looking at lots of paintings of a certain size hung on walls? It didn't seem to be a lot of dangerous work on display at Frieze. Is that a way of understanding the market?
It was not the most adventurous Frieze. There is a lot of there are a lot of wall pieces.
Yeah,
a lot of paintings, a lot of photography,
a lot of drawings, works on paper.
A lot of drawings, works on papers. Yes, that's true. And you know, is a trend in art which has to do and hasn't got to do with the market. But of course, you know, when you see this kind of easier pieces, you think that they're playing it safe somehow.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, as you say, it's not that the artists are making the work to fit the market in most cases, I think. Yeah. I mean, artists are working in all sorts of media, but obviously it's an issue about what the galleries select to bring. But there's an interesting dynamic going on, isn't there? Because we have art fairs at the minute that are been playing it safe somewhat, and you can understand it. It's a big investment to come to Frieze, particularly if you're not from London. You've got to put your staff up for a long time in an expensive city. You've got to ship the work. It's an investment, so you need to make a return on that investment. But at the same time, we have galleries in London and elsewhere opening absolutely monumental spaces which need monumental art to fill them. So I'm not quite sure where we're going with that.
We could be having this same discussion after the Armory, after the Frieze extension in New York as well next year. I think it's one of those ones that runs and runs. But I have seen you both sneaking out of the art fair with a piece of canvas under your arm. I thank you very much for joining me, Jane Morris, editor of the Art Newspaper, and Massimo Torrigiani, director of the Shanghai Art Fair. Thank you. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. Stay tuned for part two, where we'll be going to New York's refurbished Armory, popping to Tokyo to hang out at Bonjour Records, and talking publishing trends at the Frankfurt Book Fair with Simon Prosser. But before all that, Anna Brun.
Do to believe that the other wants only what's good for you.
I love Anna Brun's Do You Remember? I love that. It's good having the things on the show that we've played on the weekly sometimes as well. You get two bites of the cherry. In the first of one of our regular features, this one is called Nice Rack, as in CD rack. We might change the name because we might get some complaints, but we're going to be visiting record shops, bookshops, art galleries and cinemas as well to speak to programme directors of cinemas to see what's coming up, what they're playing, what they're looking forward to playing, and who comes into their shop or cinema. And first up, we're going to Tokyo, where Kenji Hall headed to one of the city's best-loved music stores, Bonjour Records, in the Daikanyama district to get the staff's recommendations on the latest in cutting-edge tunes. To commemorate its 15 years in business, Bonjour just this month renovated its shop, adding a cafe, Bonjour Brown Water, that might also need a rebrand, and opening the second floor area for clothes and fashion accessories sold under the Bonjour Record Boys label. Kenji went along to check out the opening party and meet their buyer Kohei Anuki, who introduces us to the shop's hottest selling albums and offers a few of his own top picks.
You come in and you immediately see on a table some of the items that Bonjour Records is recommending. Right now we have a mini pop-up shop for a collaboration between Tokyo-based cutting-edge streetwear brands, Phenomenon and Revolver. We have t-shirts, hats, and other items that are exclusively sold at this shop. On your right, after you come in the door, there are CDs that we recommend and want people to check out. On the left, we have the new cafe, Bonjour Brown Water, which serves drip coffee and a few chairs and tables where customers can pull things from the shelves and have a closer look at. Beyond the cafe, we have fashion DVDs, design, art, and fashion books, and hard-to-find magazines that you won't really see in any other store here, to distinguish us from ordinary music shops. Before the renovation, the store was very simple. There were no chairs or tables. There was no cafe. We had this idea that, by renovating, customers could come and hang out for a while, rather than just staying for long enough to buy a few things, and then going elsewhere. We have Wi-Fi they can use for free, too. Now we go up to the second floor. We have items from our own brand, Bonjour Record Boys, which is fusion of the fashion and music scenes. Creative director Daisuke Jemma was the man behind the look of this space. We wanted to suggest a music-inspired uniform for men in this first collection for Bonjour Record Boys. Seems simple and orthodox, and yet it is full of the details that are distinct to Bonjour Records. Our customers are people who are interested in music and fashion. There are also musicians and DJs who drop by to look for new music. And our art and fashion books are popular among writers, photographers, and stylists. Before the renovation, the best-selling album was Chilly Gonzalez's The Unspeakable Chilly Gonzalez. Gonzalez, a Canadian rapper, pianist, and producer who lives in France, put out an album a year ago called Ivory Tower that was in the pop genre and went on to become a big hit. This album features his dark side. Going in deep tonight, slippers on my feet tonight. It has him rapping to the accompaniment of a full orchestra.
Toro i moi. Freaking out.
Toro y Moi, the stage name of American artist and producer Chazwick Bundick, has been associated with chill wave, a genre that emerged last year. His latest album has five new songs. Earlier in 2011, he released an album, Underneath the Pine, that relied heavily on live instruments. For Freaking Out, which was released in September, he's come out with an homage to the 70s and 80s disco sound that is a big influence on his work. Anyone who likes 70s and 80s tunes would find this easy to listen to.
That was by Kohei Onuki from Bonjour Records in Tokyo. I love that, Chili Gonzalez. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now, the world of publishing rallied in Frankfurt last weekend for their annual book fair. It's the largest of its type in the world, with over 7,300 exhibitors from over 100 countries, and 300,000 people visit every year. I'm joined in the studio by Simon Prosser, publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, who's just kind of come bleary-eyed, possibly, from a bar or a plane or both, from Frankfurt. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be here.
And how was Frankfurt for you?
It was. I'm still processing it, and my shirt still need laundering, and I've yet to unpack my suitcase. But it was good. It was good. I mean, as with every Frankfurt, you go in the hope that there might be some incredibly hot book that you've missed, and you're going to hear about it from a slightly obscure agent and get to it and publish it, or acquire it first. There wasn't really anything like that for me, but there was a lot of catching up with publishers from the States and European countries and some agents, and really just far-flung network of publishing friends.
And for our listeners, you might want to shed some light on what the publishing director of Hamish Hamilton and Penguin does when he goes to the Frankfurt Book Fair. Do you get off the plane with a bundle of manuscripts tied in string under your arm, or are you buying, selling, or is it all about future planning?
It's sort of all three, actually. So you usually go to the fair with a book or two that you have world rights for, and your rights team will be there, and they'll be pitching it hard to, or pitching those books very hard to all of the people that they're meeting, because the sales side of Frankfurt is really big, actually, and there are probably more salespeople there than editorial publishing people. But at the same time, what I'm doing is talking to colleagues who do similar things in France or Spain or Italy, seeing if they've heard of things that I might have missed. And they could be English language titles, actually. Cause some of those guys will have come via New York, and they may well be, you know, more up to date on what's happening there. So I'm hoping to do that. And then beyond that, it's just keeping in play that series of friendships, really, and people who over the years you've come to trust and you think their taste is good.
And in terms of trends, we've talked about vampire books before, and there's all sorts of fashions come and go in publishing, as they do, obviously, in everything else. What were the sort of key headline trends this year?
Well, zombies are still with us, right. The undead. You can't kill them. They keep coming back. So probably the biggest deal of the fair, although not a book I personally would publish, but it's a 12 book series of zombie novels called Zom-B, I think, by
oh,
a
nice
young
name.
Adult author, yeah. Bought by Simon & Schuster UK for seven figures, but no idea exactly how much. But yeah, zombies. Beyond that, I wouldn't say I noticed any particular new trends. What the one thing everyone is obviously talking about is the threat or opportunity of ebooks and what that means.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about how zombie movies and zombie books, and presumably books for younger readers, therefore more tech-savvy readers, we probably presume, is their market being swallowed up by e-books quicker than more literary fiction?
It's really hard to know. And the trends in the States, where e-book readership is far advanced on anywhere else in the world, although the UK is catching up, seem to indicate a rather strange phenomena, like readers of romantic fiction. So lots of readers, you know, one can assume women of, from, let's say...
You almost said a certain age,
didn't you? I managed to get around that one. Women of, say, they've... I don't know, 40 upwards are buying in large quantities romantic fiction and downloading it to their Kindles, which is fascinating. Whereas what I've noticed here is that, at least on the Hamish Hamilton list, which is very much a literary list, is we're seeing really high take-up on some really quite edgy male younger writers, which again, you know, might make sense or other reasons for that, but no one really knows. And I think different cultures will produce different sets of results.
Do you get a sense of the percentage of ebook versus paper publishing when you get to Frankfurt? Does paper seem to be diminishing in the last sort of 2 or 3 years? I mean, is that a definite trend?
You're still surrounded by a lot of books and paper, and all the standards are books. The thing about e-books is very hard to show them in any way. So you get out your device and demonstrate it. But I guess what you assume now is that pretty much everything that's in print form, unless it's a highly illustrated book or a complex colour book, is probably going to have an e-book equivalent. You can assume that.
And if I went to Frankfurt, if I was at Frankfurt last week and you were showing me around, would I see authors doing readings from novels, and would I see sort of big stands of proposed front covers and front cover designs, as well as seeing lots of people furiously having meetings, gin and tonic fueled meetings in corners? What would I see? What's the sort of the vibe?
Well, there are probably two Frankfurts, and there's the daytime Frankfurt, which begins with the walk from your Intercontinental Hotel or one of those large hotels in downtown Frankfurt. Your walk to the fair, which is in the halls, big concrete halls with moving walkways going between them. It's a vast complex, actually. And once you get into the hall, if you're in Hall 8, which is a giant hall full of English language publishers, you'll see a variety of stands varying in size from the very small to the really quite large, all of them with blow-up pictures of books or authors and books everywhere. And in the middle of these stands, crammed in, are many, many tables, usually with 3 or 4 chairs and people just vigorously having meetings. And then the aisles are full of people wandering around from place to place. And so that's the sort of daytime Frankfurt. Most people have half an hour meetings back-to-back all day. Then the literary publishers, at least, will then leg it out of the fair to get to the Hessische Hof, which is a very grand hotel over the road. And that's where the second Frankfurt begins. And when you arrive in the rather plush bar there, it will, even at 5 o'clock, be pretty rammed with very senior publishers, often extremely stylishly dressed from all over Europe, heads of houses, the odd CEO, and a lot of the younger literary publishers around as well. You then depart for dinner, which has probably been arranged in advance, and it's probably very crowded in a restaurant. It takes a very long time for the food to arrive, but fun.
And then you're lubricated before the schnitzel turns up, right?
And then then probably the most sort of famous part of the fair for literary publishers is the institution that is the Frankfurter Hof Hotel, which is a very grand gilded hotel with a rather amazing large bar with marble floors, and which, if you arrive any time after about 11, will be absolutely rammed like a nightclub with, again, with mostly literary publishers from all over the world and agents. And there are no clocks in there, and there's no way of telling the time. And if you're not careful, you'll finally emerge.
Takes their watches off, puts them in their jacket pocket, and goes for it.
Yeah, they do. It's an amazing bar with a great bar staff who somehow cope with these hundreds of literary types.
So all the good books that come out of the Frankfurt Book Fair, all the good books that we see on Hamish Hamilton and Penguin's lists, essentially come about in a haze of accidents, right?
It's usually a colossal error to buy a book at Frankfurt, actually, in that way. And I've done it once, and it's very hard in that sort of atmosphere to judge the right price for a book, really.
And we talked about the well-dressed sort of European set and international set at Frankfurt. Obviously, more books are published in English than any other language. How international is the turnout compared to actually what gets published?
It's very interesting you ask. I think we have an incredibly poor record in the UK and the US, actually, but more in the UK for translations from other countries. Whereas if you go to Germany or Holland or Scandinavia, it's astonishing the number of English language titles they publish. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if someone told me 30% of all the literary publishing in Germany was in English. I really wouldn't be surprised, originally in English. Here, you're probably talking about 1%.
You're listening to Monocle 24. We're back after this.
The design desk at Monocle has teamed up with the clever radio people at Revo in Scotland to develop a special edition of their handsome heritage radio, complete with a one-touch button to take you straight to the smart and smooth sounds of Monocle 24. With its easy-to-use station listings interface, iPhone and iPod dock and remote control, the Revo Monocle Special Edition Heritage is a sharp addition to home or office. For more details, visit monocle.com, where you can order the Heritage for £300.
Monocle subscribers enjoy a special discount. Just quote your subscription code.
Most of us just imagine the future, but some people are shaping it. Presented by Mercedes-Benz, The Avant-Garde Diaries is a digital portrait magazine profiling the people whose passion and creativity drive change. Meet the visionaries of our time at theavantgardediaries.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. New York's Armory is a red brick landmark, renowned of late for housing artists and their shows, after being built originally to house New York's 7th Regiment in the 19th century. But the poor old dear that occupies a whole block of the Upper East Side has been crumbling. So the builders have been round in the form of Swiss architects Herzog and de Meuron's multi-phase $200 million renovation. Our New York correspondent, Aisha Spears, went to find out about the patch-up.
My name is Rebecca Robertson, and I'm president of the Park Avenue Armory. And we are a new cultural organization that has an extraordinary building. We have a building that has a 55,000 square foot drill hall and 18 kind of ruined period rooms that are large and palatial, but over time have kind of disintegrated. But there's something kind of splendid about them. And we are putting this building into the service of the arts.
And how long have you been working here?
I got involved as a volunteer to help save the building because, you know, it's an extraordinarily important building with really important designers, the Stanford White and Louis Comfort Tiffany. So I got involved to help rescue the building. But once I saw that drill hall, then what I really got interested in was the possibility of doing arts in that huge space. And then, quite honestly, these beautiful rooms also work for both visual and performing arts. So, you know, we just want the building to be alive with artists and art.
I am so delighted that you are all here to see the unveiling of our first two historic rooms.
What we opened today were the first two historic rooms that we have been able to renovate under plans by the architects Herzog and de Meuron.
And how did you decide that Herzog and de Meuron were to be the people you collaborated with on this project?
It seemed that it would make sense to find architects that had the same sense of material, but also would deal with what I thought was a very difficult issue, which is how do you keep the soul of a building? This building has tremendous character. So you really want to make it modern, you want to make it functional, you want artists to be able to work in here cost-effectively and easily, but you want to keep the soul of the building. So how do you do that? I thought that they had the kind of intellectual rigor to do that. I think what's amazing about the projects that they work on is every single one is different. And so we have conserved these rooms, cleaned them, but also with Herzog and de Meuron done contemporary interventions that really make them feel fresh and today.
Congratulations, it's already very impressive.
Once the whole renovation's finished, how do you envision the space working for New York?
So I think what it's going to do is it does two things. First, there's no presentation space in New York like the drill hall, because in the drill hall you can do anything you want. There's no fixed seating. There's no break between the stage. There is no stage. You just, artists come in and they dream their environment and they create these incredible works that you wouldn't see otherwise in New York because there isn't a space like this.
What do you think it means for people to have a Swiss company working on a kind of New York institution that's going to bring in all sorts of international artists? Does it matter that this is a New York landmark, or are we opening this up to the world?
You know, even when this building was built, they had a fair, and they were Siam, China, Morocco. Even then, in 1880, this group who built this building were reaching out to the world.
Right.
Today, the notion that you're from Switzerland or Siam, I don't think it matters anymore. And I think that the contemporary work that we do, the artwork that we do, comes from all over the world.
That was Rebecca Robertson from the Park Avenue Armory in New York, interviewed by Monocle's Aisha Spears. I'm still in the studio, in the Culture Studio, with Simon Prosser from Hamish Hamilton and Penguin. We're listening to that, Simon. There always seems to be a lot of money washing around for art projects. I know this is Manhattan, not London, and perhaps it's a private finance initiative, but a $200 million renovation by two of the biggest name architects, or the biggest name architecture firm in the world. That doesn't happen in England. There isn't the same money for libraries and things like that, is there?
No, it doesn't happen in England. And I've just come here straight from the protest camp outside Kensal Rise Library on my street, which is a very famous example of a community trying to save a library, and with support from people like Zadie Smith, Alan Bennett, Stephen Fry. Many people have spoken out against this. I think Alan Bennett described it as a form of child abuse, closing this library, which was founded by Mark Twain. It started by, opened by Mark Twain, and it took 20 years to raise the money, and it's been closed in 6 months by the council.
I mean, it seems like, you know, when Bookshop's having a tough time, Waterstones was famously, you know, having a tough time, and now they're sort of under different leadership, that maybe you need to be a space that's for sale in order to sort of get a flash sort of renovation.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, obviously the Brent Council's operating under pressure from the government for cuts, but, you know, really what I would like to see is, if not the local council, then the government or philanthropists stepping in a way that they certainly might consider doing for the more glamorous art world.
Well, precisely. And also, there's a library that was started by Mark Twain, and Kensal Rise is not an unliterary area.
No, there are plenty of writers around there. It's true.
Well, you're listening to Monica. We'll be back after this. And we're going to keep it literary. It's time for another regular feature. The name's still up for grabs, but we're sticking with the brilliant Book Corner for the moment. The idea is simply to get people to read out a piece of their favourite prose. It could be a novel, a poem, or a piece of journalism, or even a recipe. First to step up to the mic is Monocle editor Andrew Tuck, reading a choice excerpt from one of the seminal works of his misspent childhood, Anthony Greenbank's Survival for Young People.
Any dog is mad which is rushing for you, jaws snapping, but only mad with rage possibly, but mad still. Do not dodge or run. Stand still. Additionally, a shouted leave may just turn the tide in your favour. When the dog has not left and is attacking you, keep your feet. Punch it on the nose. Offer an arm for it to grab so it will leave the rest of you alone. Be prepared to kick it in the throat if you can, but do not lose your balance. You are completely at a savage dog's mercy once on the ground. If you can keep your balance and are swift-footed, a good soccer player, say, throw a jacket, cagoule, anorak, duvet or life jacket, whatever you are carrying, over its head to blind it. Try to grab it by the scruff of the neck as quickly as possible, but skip clutching for its tail or it will spin round and bite you. If the dog is gripping your arm between its teeth, on no account try to rip your arm away, or you will have a torn wound instead of a clean bite. It is better to push the limb towards the back of the attacker's throat and, if you have pushed hard enough, the dog may let go. Talk to the dog quietly too, while it is gripping you. Never touch a strange dog, and, when bitten, wash the bite under running cold water. Wash in soap and water, do not rub, see a doctor quickly for an anti-rabies injection.
I love that. Try
too.
Reading that with a straight face.
I know.
I kind of got the feeling that should have been read with a sort of British public information film, sort of clipped, sort of RP voice, actually, as well.
Definitely.
And also, there was a trend for these sorts of, the sort of revival of these sorts of survival for young people books, wasn't it? Like 5 years ago, how to sort of escape an aircraft crash or...
Absolutely.
And lighter subjects.
It's now a perennial mini-genre. Every Christmas there will be something about savage animals or how to survive a nuclear holocaust. People lap it up.
But there's also the idea of being able to survive a nuclear holocaust and sort of how to kind of get an unsightly stain out of your collar in the same book. There's always the same. Anyway, we want to see more of those. They seem to be the books that sort of crowd the cash till area of most high street retailers.
Yeah, they're designed to flank the cash till, that's for sure.
They're like the sort of Bags and Maltesers in Sainsbury's, I think.
They are.
Anyway, well, that was editor Andrew Tuck's reading with some very handy advice. Can you believe that someone actually wrote that with no irony whatsoever?
No.
And maybe we've saved the best for last on Culture Today, the slightly late night idea to give a mystery guest one of our audio recording units and send them out to wherever the hell they want to go to record the soon-to-be legendary feature, 1 Minute of Sound. First up is artist Alex Hoder, who sent us back a plethora of weird and wonderful sounds from around London's Freeze Week. Here's his minute.
We're talking about Jules de Balincourt, who's a French artist living in New York. And we're in front of this great painting called Manscape. It's scratch, he paints and then scratch the painting and
it's scratched. He paints and then scratched the painting, and it's scratched. He paints and then scratched the painting, and $70,000.
Well, that could run and run, Simon.
Absolutely.
I feel like I'm in the outtakes of sort of very LSD-heavy Frank Zappa outtake session there.
Welcome to Freeze.
It sounded like the equivalent of the Frankfurter Hof bar, actually.
It did, rather. As heard from behind a little cubicle door, I don't know.
Yes, it was. Where odd. All the greatest recordings are made.
Yes.
Probably where all the deals are done.
Possibly.
Possibly not book deals or art deals. There are other sorts of deals at these places. Anyway, thank you very much, Simon, for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And I think you're going to have a book corner coming up in a couple of weeks' time too. Well, that's all we've got time for on this historic first edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Don't forget, you can listen to Monocle 24 all around the clock wherever you are at monocle.com. On our next programme, we'll be talking all things film at London and Tokyo film festivals, hearing what books people are reading in São Paulo, and getting behind the cover of the niche magazine scene in Stockholm. This show was produced by Katie Bilboa, and our researchers were Hannah Jenkins and Fernando Pacheco, who were very excited this week when Brazil's Elsa Soares came to do a special intimate session right here at Monocle's Midori House. So to play us out, here is the legendary samba artist, Elsa Soares.
Saiba que isto em mim provoca imensa dor. Só os desafinados têm ouvido igual ao seu. Eu possuo apenas o que Deus me deu. Nasceu meu rebento, não era o momento dele rebentar. Mamãe África, Muralha.